So. Hi, I'm Steve McCabe. Welcome to Crave. This is the podcast, the video cast that's dedicated to music, to films, to television, to theatre, anything that's been entertaining me and Simon Mercer lately.
This is so. This week.
Yes.
A film which is, I guess, little in scale. It's a little quirky. It's a little odd. It's very interesting and quite entertaining.
Yes.
It's an English comedy called Sometimes, Always, Never.
Yeah, so that's a small film.
It is.
There's a bigger film come out recently for some reason. Big name, big budget, big cast, and, well,
I'm sure they were hoping for a big box office too.
I'm sure they were. So possibly a big disappointment is going to be Men in Black : an international, unfortunately, the film is basically the contents of a colon. But moving swiftly onwards.
For the first time since we've started Crave.
Say it's not so.
I have a new Bruce Springsteen album to talk about.
My word.
Yes.
So will you manage to squeeze a few, do you think you can put a few words together about that?
Oh, one or two.
You think they might be coherent?
I hope so.
Or is it going to be, squeeze? It is, it's going to be squeeze.
It's going to be squeeze.
Right, and I've been telling Simon about a new TV series called Years and Years.
Years and Years?
Years and Years. You didn't get the second text message I sent you, did you?
Oh, I didn't.
I autocorrect changed the second Years to Yeats.
And I texted the poet.
W.B. Yates, right. So then I texted you immediately saying, no, that was a typo. It's got no Irish poetry in it at all. So it's not called Years and Yates, which is what it says on the script.
Right.
Yeah, that would be a very, oh, good Lord, that would be a very different TV series.
But this is called Years and Years.
Years and Years.
I'm not familiar with it. I look forward to your education of my
I shall try and do it in Irish verse.
Would you? Or at least an Irish accent would be good.
Yes, very well.
Anyway,
In the meantime,
let's start with the film.
Yes, let's do it.
And this film, I just call it a comedy, but that might be underplaying it a little bit. It's called Sometimes, Always, Never. We've got Bill Nighy, a very well-known...
Oh, yeah.
And a particular actor who always has a certain type of character he tends to play in that sort of comedic way that he does. He plays a man called Alan. He's struggling with the disappearance of his son, Michael, who's disappeared, we think, quite possibly he's died. And in this film, Alan, we see how he also struggles with his surviving son,
yes,
who's called Peter, and he's played by an actor called Sam Riley. And Peter is married to Sue, played by Alice Lowe, and has a son called Jack, played by Lewis Healy. And so it's a family story.
It is
about the loss of the son, or perhaps the brother, and it's it does deal with grief and loss and how people cope with it. And you've got some other characters who are quite woven into the story as well. Played by a couple of also very well...
Very, very well-regarded British actors.
Yes.
Yeah,
so this is an actress you took you a second to click who it was.
Yeah, Jenny Agutter. I mean, I don't think it's any kind of a spoiler because her name's obviously in listings and stuff, yeah. But it took me a second to realise who she was. More obvious was Tim McKinney.
Yeah.
Who obviously we recognise from Blackadder.
Yes.
Obviously toning it down a little bit from the Lord Percy stuff.
We should point out, they play a couple who've also lost a son.
Yes.
So there's a... there's a parallel unfolding that goes on there, and interwoven through this whole film is this, is it a meme? Is that, what would you call it? That, I don't know. Or is it just a way of telling the story through the game of Scrabble?
Yes, it was definitely it was a thread that ran through it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Scrabble came in a number of different ways. So you got the story of these characters. Yeah, you know, it's a typical sort of very low key British film.
Yeah.
So. The story isn't really what matters so much as it's the interplay between these characters who are all trying to figure out in their own way, with limited degrees of success, how to handle the loss of a close family member.
Yes.
Or the possible loss.
Yes.
And the confusion and the limbo that comes with not even knowing if they
exactly,
have lost.
Exactly, exactly.
And then you've got the sort of the central dynamic is between father and son. And the son always feeling like he's less important than the son that's lost. And there's constant references back to everything in the family being second best. Even me, I'm the second best son.
Yes, yes.
And so it's actually quite a painful film in that regard. It's very
sad. I think it is. It is. It has. There is a deep sadness in it, isn't there? But I found that to be accurate,
yes,
telling, and a realistic telling, and it was poignant because of that.
Yes,
and the acting was not overplayed. Even Bill Nighy, who can be a little bit of a caricature of himself in some roles,
he can sometimes be Bill Nighy as Bill Nighy.
Yeah, I think he tried to play it down, yes, quite a few degrees, and I think that worked well. And he's not in the film all the time, which also helped, I think.
No, he's the central character. Yeah. He's not the only character.
No, and there's a lot of time spent with the grandson and, yes, the son, the other son, who's the surviving son. So, look, I think this overall, yeah, was an emotional, touching film. But you talked about there being a little oddness to it, and I found the same. How was the oddness manifested for you, Steve? Ooh,
well, I kept thinking that they've been watching a few too many Wes Anderson films.
Okay.
It never became overwhelming, but there's an awful lot of very, very tiny detail.
Yes.
I mean, it's clearly set in the present day. They're all doing stuff on their cell phones, and yet they've got these big, old, deep cathode ray TVs in the living rooms. It's very, very hard to put a to figure out the time on it.
Mm.
You were mentioning before we started recording, the way that they film car journeys.
Yes.
And you mentioned Alfred Hitchcock. It's, yes, that wonderful, really, we're making no attempt at realism.
Yes.
Rear projection stuff.
Yeah.
That was bizarre.
It was a little bizarre. And there are other visual touches.
Yes.
You'd see a sequence and then there'd be a break and there'd be a little three or four or five little still shots.
Yes.
To introduce a scene. And then there was some odd, well, I say odd, some split screens, and
yes,
and it just gave the visual flow. I wasn't quite sure what the intent was, other than it made me slightly feel like I wasn't sure what's coming next.
Yes,
and maybe that was okay. Maybe that, because it does, you're not quite sure where the film will necessarily take you.
No,
and right at the end there is the, it dangles in front of you, without giving too much away, the prospect of possibly finding this lost son. I won't say how that ends, but
no.
And that was a deft wee touch, I thought.
Yeah.
This isn't a big film, as you said. It's not packing out the cineplexes, but if you
in
get
fact,
it...
In fact, I had the cinema to myself when I saw it last night.
Well, I had two other people when I saw it.
Crowded.
Excellent. But I hope it's around for a bit longer, and I would really recommend it. It's a touching film.
It is. It's lovely. I mean, like I say, it's very, very small, and what makes it is like the script, for example, by Frank Cottrell Boyce, who wrote things like 24-Hour Party People, is detailed.
Yeah, it's a nice script.
He picks out tiny details in people's lives and the way they speak. You notice Bill Nighy, he plays a tailor.
Yes.
Which is the significance of the film's title.
Yes.
The three buttons of a classic gentleman's suit.
Yes.
Top button, you button sometimes, middle one always, bottom one,
never.
Exactly, thank you. Spoken like a huge gentleman, sir. But you notice every time, he was wearing those wonderful long drape frock coats.
Yes.
And every time he took it off, he shook it out to make sure that the drape nicely before you put it over the back of a chair.
Yeah.
Just tiny, tiny details like that. That just, you could see that there was attention paid to everything. Nothing was out of place. Even his Scouse accent.
Okay.
Which was spot on.
Was it? Okay.
I mean, I'm not actual Scouse myself, but I'm Scouse adjacent.
Yeah, you are.
And I would say it was flawless.
Okay.
It was really good. And
I was just going to say, the other thing that struck me about it was it takes a quite a well-worn theme of a grandfather coming into a family home and sort of endearing himself, yes, you know, say to the grandson.
Yeah.
And that can be really saccharine if it's overdone. But it was done in a restrained and effective way. And it was a nice touch. And I just felt... It had a quality about it.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah. There was enough awkwardness in it.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was never allowed to become schmaltzy, was it?
Yeah. So
I mean, are we going to recommend it?
I think so, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you have a bit of a taste for a slightly more art house type film, yes, rather than the big blockbuster. Yes. I think this is really to be recommended. Yeah.
Now, speaking of...
Yes, blockbusters.
Big blockbusters.
Or would-be blockbusters.
Yes, yes. Very, very few blocks were being booked by this film, I don't think, as it should be. So, obviously, Men in Black 2.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about it, or shall I?
Well, all I want to say is the only reason I, other than the fact we thought we'd talk about it for the purposes of our esteemed audience, was I did think that Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson sparked well off each other in one of the Marvel films, Thor Ragnarok, and right. it was in a comedic sort of a yes. way. And it was that was the one that Taika Waititi yep. had a hand in directing and writing, and it I thought they did really well. Here they are again, and I thought okay, let's see how they get on this time round. Just goes to show why you need a good script.
Well, this is well, also you said here they are again. You mentioned three names.
Yeah,
but here's only two of them again.
Yeah,
clearly they need a Kiwi.
They do.
I think that's the moral of the story here. They need take away because, I mean, seriously, this was flat.
It was yes, flat. It was a little dull.
It really was, wasn't it?
This type of because this is not you know this is the what the third or fourth,
fourth
the Men in Black film. So we know what the general approach here is. The film opens with a sequence in. On top of the Eiffel Tower with Liam Neeson and Chris Hemsworth, where there was an opportunity for some sparkling, witty dialogue. It wasn't there. No. It was boring.
Yes, it was.
And you expect to see in this film, okay, you know you're going to get some CGI monsters playing off each other and some thrills and you get to a point where you've seen so much of the stuff. You've got to have a decent story and a good script.
But if you remember, that's what made the very first one work.
Yeah, right? The first one
You've got Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
Who's got the rumpled gruff.
Yeah.
With trademarked.
Yeah.
And you've got Will Smith as the wide-eyed audience surrogate.
Yes.
Who manages to find absolute astonishment and even joy in what he's doing. And first of all, Tessa Thompson's character, M.
Mm-hmm.
Massive plot gap at the right. beginning of it.
Yes.
Right? She watches as two men in black, what do they call it? The memory thing. The forget me
yes.
ray.
So that ordinary humans don't remember what they've
that's
seen.
That's the one.
Yes.
She watches as they do that to her parents.
Right.
And remembers it.
Yes.
So surely there's something wrong there. But anyway, she then has an awareness that the Men in Black are a thing. She
yes.
knows they exist, and she
yes.
knows that aliens exist, and she then dedicates her every waking moment to tracking them down, which kind of undermines a lot of the idea of what made the first one brilliant. Now, obviously, you can't remake the first
one,
because that would be boring.
Yeah.
Instead, you need to find some other way of giving her a sense of wonder. And she was never overly impressed. Even with a great big... Do you remember the
yes.
outside St. Paul's Cathedral? Where
yes.
Chris Hemsworth keeps on pulling more and more things out of the car.
Yes.
And she doesn't seem remotely impressed.
Okay. I'll tell you what. I'll slightly differ with you. I hear what you're saying. I of the two performances of the two leads, I like Chris Hemsworth. I like him as Thor.
Yes.
And I find him a very likable bloke.
I mean,
I think he's sort of bloke you could imagine. If he walked in right now, he'd sit down, we'd have a beer with him, and you'd...
You'd have a great time.
You have a great time with the guy. I found his portrayal a little bit too close to what I think I've seen even in Thor or other roles. And I don't know, just felt a little bit like going through the motions. That was my take on it.
Yep.
I thought Tessa Thompson had, for me anyway, a little bit more involvement in it. I think you felt opposite to that. I thought she and Emma Thompson sparked off each other reasonably well.
Yes, that was probably the best dynamic in the film.
Yeah. But that aside, the film need to work. The film kind of really, in the end, because we've seen all the special effects before and the story is neither here nor there,
yeah.
the film has to have those two lead actors really sparking off each other to really fly.
And
it didn't...
Without the script.
Yeah, and the script was... You know, I'm sure we both sort of make a few notes as we go along with these films. I didn't find myself writing down anything from the script, really.
Well, there were a few... No, well, yes, true. There's sometimes you hear lines and think, that's just going to live with me forever.
Yeah.
I mean, let's say, you know, Quentin Tarantino's got a new film coming out later this year. And you want to buy the script and memorize the entire thing because you know before you've even seen it, it's going to be memorable.
Yes.
There's nothing about this film.
We've seen it all before. That is the problem.
We've seen it better before. Because it's reached the point now, I think, where it seems like the big set pieces and the choreography and the CGI is put first, and anything resembling script is only there to drive you from one set piece scene to another. It's how it's starting to feel, and that just doesn't make for a good film anymore.
No, because that's sort of like the Chris Hemsworth role and the Tessa Thompson role. They needed to be, I don't know, like Indiana Jones and the kid and the fix, or the love interest in the first one, or they needed to be Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or they needed to be,
you
know, they needed to be of that level of interaction and bouncing off each other, sparking off each other to really make this work, I think. And I don't think it was there.
Not at all.
Just as a quick aside.
Go on.
Prior to the release of this film, one of the other main actors in it, Liam Neeson, copped a lot of flack in the media for some comments he made about mate who might have got in trouble and being attacked by a black guy. And Neeson made a comment about something along...
wanted to go out and mess up a black bloke.
And I do wonder whether that really also somehow undermined the potential success of this film. I might have, because he has a significant role.
He plays high tea.
Yeah,
which is a bit cheesy.
Anyway,
I mean, it's a by-the-by. Yeah, let's go back to the other thing that got wrong with this film.
Okay.
We could do an entire episode just on that. So what did you make of Pawnee?
I've actually forgotten who Pawnee is.
Camille Nanjiani's little on the shoulder character.
Yeah, well, to begin with, I thought it was awful.
Yep.
I have to be honest and say, as the film progressed, maybe this is a telling remark.
Yeah.
I started to get more attached to Pawnee, maybe more than I was to the other human characters.
I think that says more about the shortcomings of the human characters than it does anything about the strengths of Pawnee.
Yes, I think, yes.
I mean, it felt to me like we've seen that character in Disney cartoons.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Everyone,
In Aladdin, that was Iago.
Yes.
Jiminy Cricket, any of those things. You know,
yes.
The Timothy Mouse in Dumbo. We've had that character in all kinds of Disney films before. It doesn't belong in a film like this.
No.
They obviously never explain where it came from.
No.
If they're Men in Black, do you remember what the entire co-popper of Men in Black was originally? Why were they Men in Black?
To protect the Earth from alien invasions?
Yeah, but what that was.
But why in black?
Yes.
I don't remember.
The whole point of it was that there were Men in Black because it made them as anonymous and as immediately forgettable as possible.
Okay.
Which, oddly enough, is what this film is. But the whole point was that they just immediately just get forgotten. Nobody notices you. If you're just wearing a black suit, a white shirt and a black tie, nobody notices you. That was the entire point. So, when they go to the souk in Marrakesh, and they're wearing black suits and white shirts and black ties, that completely undermines the entire premise of Men in Black.
Yes.
In the same way that when Chris Hemsworth pops on a nice pair of pink trousers, sky blue shirts, to sail off to the James Bond lair where Rebecca Ferguson playing Zaphod Beeblebrox is hanging out.
Yes.
It makes you realise that they didn't even know what film they were making.
No.
They forgot, basically, what this film was. And it simply became a smashy alien film.
Yeah, and it was a hodgepodge. You're right. It had part of it felt like a bit of an attempt at a James Bond type, or at least a parody thereof,
or possibly Chris Hemsworth's audition.
Yeah, maybe
for when Daniel Craig finally hangs his all the PPK.
Well, he's got the physical attributes, but I don't know whether. Anyway, that's a by the by.
And anyway, Idris Elba's getting the job anyway. Enough said. So yeah, but like you say, hodgepodge.
Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, I suppose for a youngish audience who aren't familiar with the other earlier films, there's a bit of fun to be had, a few fights and action sequences and chases and some humour that a teenager might find interesting, maybe. But if you have seen the previous ones, and if you are, given that these days the general quality of a lot of this type of film is, you know, can be quite high,
why would you slum it and waste your money on this nonsense?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, I'm not.
Sure. I mean, if I was Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, I'd be pretty disappointed, I think.
Yeah.
I would be.
Actually, do you know who I'm most disappointed in?
Who?
Emma Thompson.
Yes.
What is going on with her lately?
I don't know.
You saw the children. Did you see the children act?
I did.
Yeah. I mean, she was Emma Thompson in that, wasn't she?
Yeah.
With all that entails.
Yeah, she was good.
Yeah. But then, do you remember Johnny English Reborn?
Yes.
And then we've got this.
Yes.
Now, Late Night, that's coming out very shortly, her and Mindy Kaling, looks like it's going to be something a little bit more special.
I hope so.
Back to actual Emma again, right?
Yes.
But, I mean, has someone got like a box of compromising Polaroids of her or something? Because seriously, it's either that or, like I wrote in my review on cravepodcast.com.
Well said.
What was I saying?
wrote on that review, Steve.
As I wrote on that review, that's what I was going to say. Gambling debts?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, clearly, she needs the money.
Massive money.
Because she's frankly, she's pissing away her reputation as one of the finest actors of her generation here.
Yeah, it is odd. It is odd. You're right.
Yeah. So I do wonder what she thought she saw in this film. Mm. I mean, Liam Neeson at the moment is, quite frankly, probably grateful he's got a career left at all.
Yeah.
That for some quite asinine remarks that he made. But Emma Thompson, as far as I can tell, is other than a couple of bizarre script choices, has yet to blot a copybook. So what's she doing in nonsense like this?
Mm. And having said, but the thing is, as nonsense as it was, if it hadn't been for her, I mean, her little scenes were quite well done. But probably I remember her more than anyone else in the film.
Exactly,
but,
yeah.
But that doesn't really save the film.
No.
So I think this is, in my book, not to be recommended. You're not missing anything by giving this a wide berth. And I hope Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, who are both actors I actually like.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
And I think can be very enjoyable to watch on screen, find something better next time.
Yeah, frankly, guys, if you watch it, seriously, a word with yourself, please. And to anybody else who's watching, do not go and see this film. Do not encourage them. Mm. They'll only make them want to make another one.
Mm.
And they shouldn't.
Okay.
Skyscraper Stan has recently released a new album, Golden Boy, Volumes 1 and 2. And he's been talking to Crave about his new album and his upcoming New Zealand tour. So in August, we're going to see Stan Woodhouse, better known to the world as Skyscraper Stan, coming over to New Zealand to promote his new album. And so Stan's joined Crave today to tell us all about it. So, Stan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the new album, Golden Boy. What's that title all about, first of all?
Well, it's about... It's about being a golden boy, ultimately. Only son in the family.
Right.
Grew up being called golden boy by my sisters. I was, you know, mum's golden boy. But then over, you know, the last couple of years have been a time of a lot of reflection about what that position kind of means, what that innate privilege kind of means. And so I explored those themes in the songs, both autobiographically and with sort of character pieces and things. I like to write character driven songs and narrative driven songs, so it's all about sort of trying to better understand the fact that I was kind of just gifted through basic genetics an easier road than some.
Right.
And just thinking about that.
Fair enough. Well, and I mean, your lyrics do tend to be quite personal, don't they? So I'm just looking at the track listing. You kick off with a song called Dole Cues and Dunhill Blues.
Mm.
Now, is that autobiographical particularly?
That one is not. No. So the first five tracks on the album have autobiographical elements, but they tend to be mainly more character-driven.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, because a song like Doorbell is... well, if that were autobiographical, I think we'd be having a very different conversation.
Yes, we would be. That is, yeah, that is a song about the refugee crisis. So it would just generally be, I don't know, we might be having this conversation over Skype, but I'd probably be on Manus.
Fair enough, yes, it would be a very different conversation, wouldn't it? So I mean, going back to Dole Cues, I mean, that's a very heavy song. It's one of your darkest lyrically and musically that I've heard from you in a while. What kind of place did that come from?
That came from traveling around. I was playing a lot of shows traveling through the central tablelands of New South Wales.
Right.
And I don't know if you've traveled through there. As this is a New Zealand podcast, I can say without fear of reprisal that it's got some bad juju. it's
Would you care to expand on that?
Well, terrible things happened there.
Right.
In the colonial era, and then it's subsequently, since then, it's become a very depressed area, and it's got very limited opportunity for a lot of people who are living there, younger people, a lot of gambling. I think one site that I saw in Orange when I was driving through there really sums the area up quite well. There's a juvenile detention center.
Yeah.
that has its double security fence for the rec yard backing onto an 18-hole golf course for the gentry.
Right. So yes, there's a bit of a juxtaposition going on there, yeah?
There is, yeah. And a lot of the towns there are just not in a great state, boarded up. It's a difficult spot. Right. There's a lot of anger. There's quite a homogeneously white population.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of drinking. And it's so that song takes place in the Central Tablelands of New South Wales.
Fair enough. I shall listen to it again with a new perspective in that case.
Yeah.
Now I did notice you've divided this album into volume one and volume two. So that's, you say, the slightly more personal stuff in, I guess, what once we would have called side two.
Yeah, well, so I made this album to sit nicely on a vinyl record.
Right.
I don't buy CDs anymore. So I wasn't going to make an album geared for a CD.
Yeah.
So I split it into two volumes, because one side is side one that opens with Dolkies and Dunhill Blues. That is just a more aggressive side of the record.
Right.
A lot of the songs sort of sit in the minor chord area.
Yeah.
A lot of them are a bit more driving. They're generally more character driven.
Okay.
And then side two, we start moving into sort of some slightly more major chord songs, and things get much more autobiographical at that point.
Right. So I noticed some of the songs we've heard before, so like Dancing on My Own Grave, for example, I seem to remember hearing you play live in the past. So these are songs that have been percolating for a while, I assume.
Yeah, so these songs, some of them, songs like Dancing on My Own Grave are a little bit older.
Yep.
And the majority of tracks for this album were written over the last sort of 2.5 to 3 years.
Right. Okay, fair enough. So what was I going to say? So I'm just looking at some of the titles. Again, they're looking a bit bleak, aren't they? Again, I mean, you say that side two is the more major chord side, but we've still got a song called Talking About the Weather, brackets, While the House Burns Down, close brackets, yeah. Which doesn't sound like too much of a laugh riot, to be fair.
Well, but the song sounds happy. Compositionally, you know.
Oh, okay, fair enough. So not just going simply with the bleakness of the lyrics.
It's sort of talking about the weather while the house burns down, kind of not coming at something head on.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Well, being English, I can relate to that one, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, listen, I have to ask you about something you just said then that intrigued me. You said, I don't buy CDs anymore. So does this mean you've gone completely electronic?
Yeah, actually it does. I'd like to say that I have a lush vinyl collection, but I subsist sort of hovering just above the poverty line, so okay. I couldn't afford to collect vinyl even if I wanted to.
Right.
So yeah, I'm pretty much an entirely digital individual, but that doesn't stop me imagining my own music sitting on other people's record shelves.
Ah, oh, fair enough.
Yeah,
so a nice way of thinking about it. So let's talk a little bit about the tour that's coming up. I'm looking at the announcement. You're starting off over on the West Island, doing a few of those places, and then you're coming to New Zealand in August.
Mm-hmm.
And I see you doing Littleton, Dunedin, Auckland, and Wellington.
Yep.
Anyway, you're particularly looking forward to?
All four of them are going to be fantastic. I haven't brought a band to New Zealand since like November 2016, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So I'm really looking forward to traveling through with a band. We've only got the four dates.
Yes.
I would like to do more. There's we're coming back in October, but that's a secret.
Okay.
The I'm really looking forward to the Dunedin show. I've not been to the Cook yet, but okay. I've heard things. We've got Emily Fairlight supporting us there, and she's great.
Do we know who's going to be opening for the other shows yet?
I actually am, I haven't booked the Auckland support. I'm looking forward to finding out who Tuning Fork booked for that. They've opted to book the support for that. I'm sure it's going to be somebody I really like. And Wellington, I still need to book. We've got Ryan Fisherman supporting in Lyttelton.
Okay.
I've been to the other three venues. Cook's the only venue I haven't been to, so I know the other three I'm all looking forward to going back to. I really like all three of those venues.
Fair enough.
And it's just going to be nice to be home.
Excellent. So New Zealand is still home then, yeah?
Yeah, New Zealand is still home. I do consider myself somewhat Australasian. I've got a soft spot in my heart for Australia. I do love it over here. It's a very interesting place. This July is going to be my 10th anniversary.
Wow.
I've been here for 10 years. I left New Zealand 10 years ago. I've been around, bouncing around a little bit, but the majority of that time has been spent in Australia, and I do, you know, I do have a soft spot for this country.
Fair enough. Well, we're glad that you're coming back over to God's Own Country in August, and we'll look forward to seeing you then.
Looking forward to seeing you, Steve.
Now, Simon.
Yes.
Simon.
Yes.
I know you sit there. I mean, you've brought props, haven't you?
if you're just listening to this, I'm holding up a certain cover of a CD.
Yes.
And it's got a horse on it.
And you're gazing reverentially at it. Although you're holding it almost sacramentally, aren't you?
No, it's Western Stars. It's the new album, the 19th studio album from Bruce Springsteen.
I've heard of him.
Hmm.
He's
quite good. And as I pointed out in my review on cravepodcast.com, I've actually been following him. Actually, it's 41 years.
Is that right now?
Yes. Wow. So that's quite a long time.
That's not a passing infatuation.
No, it's not a passing infatuation.
That's dedication.
That is dedication.
His mother's not been listening to him that
website. A couple of little interesting aspects of the background to this album is that it was actually written and put together maybe 3 years ago.
Oh, right. Okay.
He was waiting for a time to release it.
Well,
he's been
a very busy man.
He's been very busy.
Years.
He had this autobiography came out, so I think he parked it to go and sort of promote the autobiography, and then that was immediately followed by this more than a year or year and a half long Broadway run with Springsteen on Broadway. So he didn't want to interfere with that. So here we are. I think it's 3 years later, something like that, when this album has come out. It's, and a lot of the advanced publicity was about the music, the instrumentation.
Yeah.
It was said to be a hearkening back to sort of that pop style of Burt Bacharach and Glen Campbell, strings and sort of a lush instrumentation from, say, the late 60s, early 70s. And that was kind of where the publicists were hanging their hat on that aspect of the album. It is there. Mm-hmm. I didn't find it so remarkably different, actually, that he's used that approach here and there in the past. I always find my main interest with this guy is, what is he saying? What's he writing about?
Right.
Where is, and you kind of get a sense of where he's at in his own life when you...
Yeah.
So this is... I'll let you have a word in just a second, but I find this interesting because this is a guy, through his autobiography and through, as we say, Springsteen on Broadway, we know now a lot more about him.
Yeah.
We know that for all the Born to Run and striking out on the road and crossing the country but then coming back and seeking a home and looking for a connection, this album is about someone who's really left home behind again and is somehow drawn out to that road yet again.
Oh, okay, fair.
And that's kind of, a lot of the characters are people who understand the importance of a family and a connection of kids, of feeling rooted somewhere, but for some reason they're out there, they're hitchhiking, they're a wayfarer, they're waiting for a train, they're the album is full of this sort of out, going out and about, and the passing of time is very, very strong in this album. The sun rises and I woke up in the morning, the sun sets, sundown.
Yeah.
It's that marking of time. This is, I guess, a man who's nearly 70.
Yeah.
You get a sense of that.
Okay, well, let me ask you then, right?
Yeah.
When we saw him.
Yes.
About 3 years ago, at Mount Smart Stadium, right? And basically, there's a reason why he plays a 3-hour set.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there's at least three Bruce Springsteens, at the very least. Like, there's a guy who plays Rosalita,
yeah.
My favourite, to be fair.
Okay.
There's the guy who plays the ghost of Tom Joad.
Mm-hmm.
There's the guy who does Pink Cadillac and Dancing in the Dark, who's probably the least interesting of all.
Yes.
And there's probably like two or three other alters in there as well, right? So who made this album?
This is a little bit of that folky country guy, a little bit of the soulful guy, and that pop, that lush pop guy. Not so much, but these aren't big commercial hits.
Right. No, there's quite a bit. They're really not, are they?
No. There are some very accessible tunes, and I think the title track, Western Stars, it's just kind of a country-ish feel. I thought was a beautiful song. This is a guy who's just been around the block a few times and is kind of drawing on a whole range of influences, because in some songs you have banjo and you have violins going. I mean, it's all sorts of... He's pulling in all sorts of sources, bringing it into something that he calls his own, which has, in a way, quite a familiar feel to it if you followed him for a long time. But it's those observations, those often very detailed observations of life, which I find enthralling. We know he's had his mental health problems. He's told us about them.
Oh, and, quite
and,
upfront,
and these are very evident in here.
Yeah.
In lots of references in the lyrics to dealing with sort of internal torment.
Yeah.
So I find that reflective, sad at times. He still has a bit of hope here and there. And drawing on a few influences. I want to read this one.
It doesn't matter what I say. I mean, you're going to do this regardless.
No. But I want to know, because I might have misinterpreted this. I want to know.
I thought he was going to start reading the entire lyric sheet.
No. Just one. In the opening line to the title track, Western Stars, I may have misinterpreted this, but so please tell me, because it's an American setting, and you are with your experience of the American culture.
I have lived among them, yes.
So I wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
Just glad my boots are on, instead of empty, in the whispering grasses down the 5 at Forest Lawn. I assume the 5 at Forest Lawn, at empty boots, is kind of like maybe a cemetery?
Forest Lawn's a military cemetery, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah,
so I think what he's saying there, I'm glad my boots are on, it's better to be alive than dead.
There's an alternative,
And I think that's... And a lot of his songs take you to deep, dark places, and he just gives you a little bit of hope and redemption at the end. And I thought that was kind of a classic example.
Well, I don't have white gloves to put on first, but if you can hand me the sleeve for a second, I shall treat it with...
No, that's fine. I think I ripped it already.
But do you reverence it? There's one title I'm trying to remember. Which one was it now? Oh, yeah, There Goes My Miracle.
Yeah.
That's the point at which I turned it off.
Okay.
Because I was listening to it, and I thought, no, this has now just reached the point where it's just simply... big swirling orchestra. And what surprised me about this is you know, America's a huge country, and its music is very, very geographically situated.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, he has always identified himself very, very strongly as being from New Jersey, one town in particular.
Yes.
And that's been central and pivotal. Okay, I know he named one of his albums after a Midwestern state, so don't start. but he's very much been a New Jersey boy. And that's been front and centre in his identity very strongly. Yes, he's gone as far west as Youngstown.
Yes.
I could hear Wyoming in this music. This is big sky. This is country. This is cowboy music. And it feels at that level, like, I mean, yes, the lyrically, I can see the thread. Musically, it felt like too much of a step away for me.
Okay. Oh, that's a legitimate view, of course.
But we can no longer be friends, can we?
No, of course we can. We're even more than... We're more close friends now. No, So I would take issue with the... I think he has... if you look at... let me give you an example. The whole of The Ghost of Tom Joad was out of New Jersey. It was in the West. A 2005 album called Devils and Dust was in the West.
Oh, okay.
Lyrically
or musically?
Both.
Oh, okay, fair
I
enough.
Think. And so he has, I think New Jersey has, he's left it and he's come back to it.
Okay, yeah.
And I understand why you might not, you know, I didn't like every song on this album. I thought it was a couple of songs too long.
CDs tend to be.
They often tend to be.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of songs there I thought were really, really nicely done. The instrumentation is interesting, isn't it? It's not my natural home.
No.
Personally.
No.
Because the album is so talking about, I guess, I know what I wanted to say. This is the point. Sorry, I'm rambling here. Throughout his career, we've talked about this before, he's one of these artists who can present a song where the music makes you feel it's going in one direction, but the lyrics take you somewhere else. And of course, Born in the USA was the classic example
there, of course.
And there have been other songs where the tune is upbeat.
Yeah.
Take Dancing in the Dark.
Yeah.
The lyrics are actually extremely down. And, you know, I woke up, you know, just... it's about depression and being alone, but the music is it's all, you think, what's going on here? And maybe that's a similar sort of thing where he's dealing with some fairly serious topics about isolation and depression and a loss of connection, but he's dressing it in a way that is more palatable and draws you into it. It may or may not succeed, but I think that's kind of what's going on. I would put this as, for me, one of the better ones of the recent output. I brought along another one called Devils and Dust. I've just all mentioned
right. it. Yeah,
if you want to hear a completely different Bruce Springsteen, have a listen to Devils and Dust. There are a few songs there where even his voice, the use of his voice, it sounds like a country, nasally. You think, is that Bruce Springsteen? But he has adopted an idea that this is how I'm going to tell this story, and that's how he's telling that story.
But let's face it, 19 albums.
Yeah.
You've been listening for 41 years. So yes. I'm sure he's been writing this stuff for a bit longer.
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know, the old joke about the new AC/DC album was, well, I've heard it 15 times already.
Yeah.
It's good that he is reinventing himself. Yeah. You don't want to hear this. I mean, I don't care how good the album is. You don't want him to keep releasing it over and over.
No. And I think he's taken some risks like that over the years. Some of them have worked and some haven't.
Right.
But that's okay. I mean, anyway, so I think if you are a Bruce Springsteen fan, and you're absolutely right, Steve, it depends on, I guess, maybe what sort of Springsteen fan you are. Which of the voices do you like the most? If you liked his rock stuff, you're not going to, this.
And that's the Bruce that I quite like.
Yeah. He's, I guess at this stage of his career, he's entitled to cast his net as wide or as he wants.
Well, I'm not sure he's necessarily making songs for you anymore. He's certainly not making them for me. I guess he's reached, he's earned the right to make songs for himself at this stage.
And let me just say.
Go ahead.
Final point. In a recent interview, he said, I wrote this, I've just written a whole bunch of songs for the E Street Band, So he has dangled the prospect of another tour. Now, they're all getting on a bit, but if they come back, Mr. McKay...
And you're just not sleeping at night.
We will be back, I'm sure.
Well, we haven't done our tour announcements yet for tonight, have we?
No, but do we need to just talk about the Yates, which is not a Yates?
Oh, yes, yes.
So anyway,
yes,
this album, I liked it. Steve, not so much. I can understand why he didn't.
It's definitely for the fans, really, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. And not all the fans, perhaps. But it is an artist, still at this later stage of his career, willing to try other things, willing to experiment, and willing to maybe displease some of his fan base.
He doesn't care anymore.
No.
Years and years. Years and years.
Yes.
Yes, years and years. Now,
tell me.
Are you a Doctor Who fan?
Are we
familiar with the new Who?
The new Who, I've seen a couple of...
Can you even say the new Who?
The new Who. I enjoyed her work from Broadchurch, and I liked her work here.
I wasn't quite that new.
Oh, okay.
What's the word here? Did I say the regeneration, I suppose, is not the wrong word to say, of the series back in the 2000s.
Okay.
Was driven by Russell T. Davis.
Okay.
Who also did Queer as Folk,
mm-hmm.
which was set in Manchester.
Okay. Dear to your heart.
Absolutely. So what Russell D. Davis has done this time is it's a six-part series
mm-hmm.
set in the Lyons family who live in Manchester.
Okay.
and it's set in the very near future.
Okay.
And it progresses over years and years,
mm-hmm.
probably over about 30 odd years. And it's an absolutely beautifully crafted story of where you could imagine, if a certain strand of British and global politics were allowed to proceed, a certain particular populistic and nationalistic brand of British and indeed American politics were to proceed,
right,
where it could conceivably go.
Okay.
And so you've got people like Anne Reed, who's a wonderful British actress, is like the matriarch of the family. The middle generation are slightly written out, and you've got her grandchildren and their families, and in particular there's one son played by Rory Kinnear, who is absolutely fantastic. And they all have different things going on in their lives as Britain collapses around them.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the rise to power of, and curiously, this is she's finally doing something right, Emma Thompson, as a politician who is basically somewhere between Margaret Thatcher and Nigel Farage.
Oh, goodness.
And
wow.
Oh yeah, she's terrifying.
Mm, okay.
And so this is Emma Thompson's character, as she comes from being just an annoying pundit on television to being somebody with serious power. And what happens to the country. And you can see there's very, very clear echoes of Brexit, of Donald Trump's rise.
UKIP and all that.
Well, obviously, I can't remember the character's name now. Thompson's character leads what she calls the four-star party.
Uh-huh.
And it's very clear that this is being closely modelled on UKIP, because she goes from being just an irritant to being someone who's actually got a little bit more clout than she's meant to, and then suddenly she's got way more clout than she's meant to. And it's kind of, on that level, it's a cautionary tale about Nigel Farage and his ilk. But then it turns inward, and it's about a family. And how do they survive? How do they muddle through the mess that's being created for them? And so for all the global geopolitics stuff that's going on and the rise of the four-star party is fascinatingly drawn, Davis always brings it back to a family.
Yeah.
And how is this family managing to survive?
And that makes the story all the more relatable, does it not?
That's what makes the story.
Yeah.
And you realise that no matter what else is going on in his world, it always is about individuals.
Yeah.
So you've got, at one point, the banking system all but collapses.
Right.
And one of the families loses the proceeds from the sale of their house. And end up all but destitute.
Right.
As a result, not of their own failure to act. Because they actually, within the context, they're trying to act prudently.
Yes.
And yet, events that are happening around them shaft them royally. And so the acting's fantastic. The script is, with rare exceptions, where every now and then you can see he's waving his flag a little bit too strongly,
right.
But for the most part, he's a great script writer. And it starts off in 2020.
Okay.
And ends in about 2030-ish,
I think.
Okay, yeah. So that's your years and years,
yes,
right there. And if I'm not mistaken, he's coming on, I think, on New Zealand On Demand TV very, very shortly.
I was about to ask you where we can access it. So, okay.
There are ways of obtaining these things.
Yeah, but certainly for the broader audience, it's about to appear.
Yes, and I would quite highly recommend it.
Yes.
If only to have an Emma Thompson palate cleanser after Men in Black.
Yeah, no, good.
Yeah, definitely worth a look, that one. I was quietly impressed. I all but binged it, to be honest.
Well, That in itself tells you something, does
Absolutely.
It not? Okay. Oh, great. Years and years. Okay, I shall look forward to that.
Yeah.
I do note you have been a little busy, or more than a little busy, on our cravepodcast.com website.
That's cravepodcast.com.
Bring us up to date with various announcements of tours and whatnot. So what are the highlights we've got to look forward to in the next little while, Steve?
Not for you and me, I don't think, quite so much, to be honest, but I know that there is a sector of the New Zealand music-loving community who likes band acts like Shaggy and Common Kings and Toots and the Maytals. Now, there's a name you've heard for quite some time. Mm-hmm. Nessie and Mystic, Sons of Zion. It's your reggae end of the spectrum.
Right.
Yep. Doesn't float my boat, but if it floats yours, Tauranga, the Domain, 25th and 26th of January next year, it's the One Love Festival.
Okay.
So apparently it's a fantastic...
I imagine.
Fantastic festival. Not my taste in music at all. In the same way...
Yes.
Not I can't imagine whose taste in music this is. Seriously. And it's another of these, like, who can we put on stage together? We've got Montel Jordan, Blue Cantrell, All For One, Young MC, and hosted by Flavor Flav.
Okay.
Yep, again, not really. I don't think that's going to speak to a man who's just been cataloguing the joys of Bruce Springsteen.
No.
But if it were, then you'd want to be getting yourself to the Logan Campbell Centre in Auckland on Tuesday the 23rd of October.
So I'm so unfamiliar with those names. I can't even tell you what genre necessarily we're talking about with those acts. Is that kind of a rappy R&B thing?
That's end of the spectrum.
That end of the spectrum.
Yes.
Okay, right. Thank you.
I mean, Flavor Flav was in Public Enemy.
Oh, okay.
So he's the MC for the night.
Okay.
And it's called Bring That Beat Back.
Bring That Beat Back. Fair enough. Okay.
Just leave it wherever you want it for my money if you want to. Yeah. We're going all over the spectrum here. Troy Sivan, I don't know if you're familiar with.
I don't know if I am, actually.
Well, he's Australian.
Well, no.
But we won't hold that against him. No. He's very much of the moment. I mean, he performed with Taylor Swift last year. So that should give you an idea.
Okay.
Although, other than Australian, we actually quite like him. I have a wife and daughter who will definitely want to go and see that.
Okay. And where's he playing? In
Spark Arena.
Uh-huh. Coming up soon?
September the 13th.
Okay, not far away.
Soon enough.
Yep.
One of the biggest announcements, although really not one, again, that's thrilling me. I'm supposed to sound enthusiastic about this, aren't I?
Well, we're just keeping people informed. That's okay.
Yeah, I know, we don't judge. Actually, we do. Don't we? Probably we actually do judge. And we will definitely judge you if you go to see Little Mix.
Okay.
Auckland Spark Arena, Thursday, December the 19th. Mm. Again, not entirely...
Well, no, hey.
Boats remaining decidedly unfloated at this point. However,
yes,
the one that does actually interest me, to be honest,
okay,
is... Were you ever a Genesis fan?
Look, I guess I was really just through their radio songs, hits. I never bought a Genesis album.
Oh, okay.
But I'm familiar with some of their... And I'm probably just more familiar with some of their post-band, you know, what Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins did later on.
Right, yeah.
As much as I am with what the band did.
Yes.
But some of their stuff I'm familiar with, yes.
Right. Well, in that case, you possibly be less impressed than I am.
Okay, go on.
With about Steve Hackett, the guitarist from their classic lineup.
Okay.
Who, again, isn't one of the names that springs to mind,
most
obviously. He's not Collins or Gabriel.
Yeah.
But he's an integral part of their sound on their big, thoroughly progressive albums.
Yes.
He's coming to Auckland June the 20th.
Okay.
Next year.
Oh, next year.
Yeah, it's just shy. It's like barely a week shy of a year away now.
Okay.
Yeah. He's going to be here at the Great Hall in Auckland.
Okay.
And he's going to be playing the entire of Selling England by the Pound.
Yep.
Which was one of the... Well, it was... Well, he was telling me this morning, don't you know?
Yes.
Yes.
Name dropper.
Oh, you we're going to be playing his interview in next week's podcast. You want to think I'm a bad name dropper? Wait till you hear the name he drops at the very start of the conversation.
Okay, right,
shameless.
Okay.
But yeah.
Anyway.
But yeah, he was saying of all the work he did with Genesis, that's his favourite album.
Tell me the title again, please.
Selling England by the Pound.
Selling England by the Pound.
And it's a concept album, as Genesis were wont to do.
Yes.
Back in those days, and he's doing that along with some of his solo stuff as well.
Okay,
and so we'll have a chat with him in next week's podcast.
Okay,
he was a lovely fella.
Yep,
really nice to talk to. Very, very musically magpie-ish, to say the least, these days.
Okay,
I think it's going to be a very, very interesting show. That
okay, great, lovely.
So
okay, excellent. Well, and if there's anything else, It's always worth dropping into our website, cravepodcast.com, because Steve keeps a lot of the announcements ticking over what's coming up. You can get written reviews of some of the music and the films that Steve and I have seen. There's some nice photo galleries.
We do our best.
And, of course, you can access the podcast and the video cast on YouTube through our website.
Indeed.
So actually...
And even if you felt really moved to...
Yes.
Get in touch with us.
Oh, We'd love to hear from you.
We absolutely would. So if you reckon the Men in Black : International is actually less dreadful than we claim it was, we would love for you to try and persuade you to try and change our minds. Yeah. Because seriously, we struggle to find good things to say about it.
Yeah.
So if you'd like to get in touch with us, podcast@cravepodcast.com.
That is the email address. You can get us on Facebook, of course. We're on our Twitter handle is Crave.
This is why I do this bit, Simon.
Yeah, go on.
There's a reason why I do this bit, right? I know we thought we'd change it up this week. Twitter, Facebook, our handle is @CravePodcast.
@CravePodcast. That's the one I was trying to get to. I'm such a social media guru.
You are, aren't you?
Yeah.
All the cool kids are doing it. Right?
Anyway.
We'd love to hear from you.
Yes. So, but until next time.
That's what's been entertaining us.
This week. Toodles. Did I say toodles? I did.
Yeah, yes, you actually did.
Can we re-record that?
No.